Mark. I'm Bill. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bill.
Glad everybody could join us this morning. Our presentation is, I met Larry, I think, just briefly at Howe Place a little over a year and a half ago. He had come up there. One of the a home group member of his was speaking up there, and I heard about his home group, and I heard it was a pretty good-sized group. So when it came time for last year's roundup to get some flyers out, get some information out, I visited their group, and it was just an enormous group of people. And I heard Larry and Christian conduct the meeting, and I really liked what they had to share. They were right from the big book. And as we prepared for this year's roundup, I talked with our chairman, Susan, about maybe inviting them over here. And Larry and I had some communications, and here they are. I'm looking forward to hear about some more about AA history. It's always something I've enjoyed hearing about and learning about, and I can't wait to hear them. So, if you will, please welcome Larry Scott and Christian Proctor.
Thanks, Bill. Good morning. Boy, it sure is good to be with y'all this morning. So good to see you. It's awfully early, though, isn't it? You know, I didn't know there was 2 7:30s in the day. I'm serious. I thought 7:30 come about when the sun was setting, you know what I'm saying? Yeah, it's an honor and a privilege to be invited to do anything today, but especially to be invited to be a part of a festivity like this. We're really honored. And I will start by telling you that my name is Larry Scott, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm free this morning. My sobriety date is December 31st, 1987. I never planned on going this far between drinks. But it's working out all right. I'm going to give you a little bit of qualification, if you will, on why we're sitting up here. I stumbled around the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous for 5 years. And I hung out on the porch, smoking the cigarettes and fellowshipping. And a couple of knuckleheads come up to me at some point and said, "Hey, have you ever read this book?" And I said, "Well, I'm sure I have. I own it." And they said, "Well, why don't you show up at a book study and we'll take you through it." And what I didn't realize at the time is Joe McQuaney and Charlie Parmerly had trained these two boys. They live over in Alpharetta. And they passed this information along to me now, and for about 14 years we've been carrying this message. And we do it all over the country, especially since Joe died, God rest his soul. And we're just honored to be able to carry this message to different venues around the country and meet you guys everywhere we go. It's a real joy. And we do a book study on Thursday nights at Dunwoody Methodist Church. It's called We Are Not a Glum Lot, and we are not a glum lot. I'd love to have you come and visit with us. It's at 8 o'clock on Thursday nights. Bill, could I get you to do me a favor? We're going to give out some handouts here and get this thing cranked up. There's not enough. I've got an extra box. We're going to do a little timeline. And when you look at this thing, you're going to ask yourself, what are they thinking? Because it starts off in the early 1900s. And what we're going to do today is walk you through God's handiwork of how he handpicked places, people, and times for the formation of Alcoholics Anonymous to bring it to what we know today. Once y'all get those in your hands.
While these papers are being passed out, my name is Christian Proctor. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 7th, 2001, and first thing my first sponsor did to me that upset me was tell me that I didn't know anything about staying sober. he took me to that blank page in the beginning of the book, and it made this, my book made this weird noise. I'm sure you can relate. It sounded like this. You know, and I opened it, and he realized, he goes, "You haven't been reading this, have you?" And I asked him how he knew, and he was just infinitely wise, I'm sure. But he taught me a little bit about what the big book was about. And then he suggested I go to a big book study, and he clarified it by saying the difference between a big book study and a big book discussion is that in a big book study, the people who've done the work are actually talking about the book. In a big book discussion, you're going to get a lot of hearsay and conjecture and opinions. And I didn't know the difference until I read the book. And now I'll sit in meetings and sometimes I'll hear things that sound great, but that's not a part of our program. Well-intentioned as it is, but that might get me drunk. And so one of the things that I learned as a result of doing the work is how to carry a message not only with an air of integrity, but most importantly with an air of enthusiasm. Because if this doesn't look good on me, why would you want it? You know, I remember watching a guy get up and pick up a white chip. And I'm going to rephrase that. I remember a guy getting up to hand out chips, and he had this, and it's really not going to translate over the recording, but he had this look on his face, see if you can relate. He goes, "If you want what we have," and I'm, wow, no. If that's what you got, is a sullen, lax, bored expression on your face, I don't want that. And I was new, and that was my experience. And so when, you know, people say, you know, "Christian, you have too much enthusiasm, you're too over the top, you and Larry have way too much fun doing this," I'm thinking, but that's what this program promises us. I mean, we are not a glum lot.
If it ain't fun, count me out.
Yeah, the most satisfactory years of our existence lie ahead. I think the book says that we absolutely insist on enjoying life. And I pursue this thing like I pursued a drink. And you know what? It's not always fun. Some days it's tough. But more days are good than bad these days. And I find it is a direct result of this program, studying this text, passing on this message, and having a God in our lives. So,
all right, you've got a timeline in your hand. And if you'll notice, it says Bookman leaves Philadelphia. They're referring to a guy by the name of Frank Bookman. Bookman was a Lutheran minister, and he leaves Philadelphia for Europe. He had established a hospice for wayward boys in Philadelphia, and he got in a run-in with the trustees of this hospice over the food budget. Keep in mind, Bookman was a minister, and his job was to preach, to carry the word of God. Well, he got this run-in going, and we know that today to be a resentment, and what did it do? It blocked him off from the sunlight of the Spirit. He could no longer be effective in his chosen profession. So he leaves and heads over to Europe. And in 1908, Bookman has a very profound conversion experience. You might want to call it a spiritual experience, if you will. And what happened there, he had gone over there to go to an evangelical conference in Keswick. And while he was there, the conference was kind of ho-hum. Hope this one doesn't turn out to be ho-hum. But it was ho-hum, and he didn't get what he was looking for there. And as he walked out onto the street, he's walking down the sidewalk, and he sees a little sandwich board sign sitting in front of a chapel, and it was a spiritual conference or talk, whatever, given by a lady by the name of Jessie Penn Lewis. And Jesse was an author and a lecturer, and during this conference, he picked up some ideas of how to overcome resentment and to get connected back with God. And what we know today is that she shared the spiritual solution with Bookman. In 1918, 10 years later, Sam Shoemaker, Episcopal minister, is... He goes to Calvary Church in New York City. Calvary Church is a big outfit. It's Calvary, it's a church. I'm sorry, Christian just corrected me. I'm getting ahead of myself. Shoemaker is an Episcopal minister, but he is in Peking, China. And while he's there, he is teaching Chinese men math. They're not wanting to learn math. They like them little boards with the beads that slide. Y'all with me?
You guys like the boards with the beads that slide too? Oh.
I don't know what they call those things, but it's not like. Anyway, they said, we don't want to learn math, so he got a resentment. Blocked him off from the sunlight of the Spirit. He can't preach anymore. So he runs into Bookman in Peking, China. And Bookman says, I got something for your resentment. And he told him about the four absolutes that he had learned from Jesse Penn Lewis. And those were honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love.
And they're absolutes.
What'd I call
perfect
them?
Perfect ideals.
Yeah.
Now remember that. Perfect ideals. Honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. What an order.
So Bookman decides to let go of self and let God guide his life. 3 years later, he becomes ordained and he goes to Calvary Church in New York City. Calvary Church is attached to Calvary Mission and Calvary House. Calvary Mission is a place for the homeless. Soup kitchen, if you will. And there's a 52-bed halfway house for alcoholic men. And he becomes a minister there. And what happens is, at this point, there's a group that's formed. It's called the First Century Christianity Movement. And later on, in 1928, it became the Oxford Groups. Okay? In 1931, Russell Bud Firestone, the son of the famous Firestone Tire and Rubber Company, he's bad to drink red liquor and show himself.
Anybody?
Okay. And he's on a train coming back from Denver, Colorado, and he's pretty lit. Well, he runs into Shoemaker on the train, and Shoemaker's got a buddy with him named Jim Newton. And they ran into Firestone and they said, we got something for your alcohol problem. And they had back then what they call the surrender prayer. And they got him on his knees in a club car on that train and introduced him to the four absolutes or the tenets of the Oxford Groups, if you will.
Up until now, none of these people have been alcoholics.
Bud Firestone's the first one. God's handpicking the places, the times, and the people. And he's putting them together. And we'll bring it all together at the end of this thing. In 1931, skip down below that, Roland Hazard comes from a very wealthy white-collar industrialist family out of the Northeast. These people have got enough money to burn a wet dog. They own Allied Signal, Allied Chemical, Burlington Industries. He had been a senator in Rhode Island, and he had politicians throughout his family. And he was an absolute sore spot in this family because of his drinking career. And Roland goes over to Switzerland to visit with the celebrated psychiatrist, Dr. Carl Jung. And while he's there, there's a lot to Roland. It's hard for me to cherry pick him because he's such a key player in this scheme of things. But while he's there, Dr. Jung tells him what the solution is. Nobody knows what the problem is yet, y'all. You with me? Nobody knows what the problem is. All they know is once they start drinking, they can't quit. Once they start thinking about drinking, they can't stop thinking about it. But he goes over there and he says, Dr. Jung, he says, I like to drink liquor and I don't know how to stop. Well, Jung tells him, he says, well, every once in a while, now and then, I've known of some people that have had what they've called a vital spiritual experience. But not once in a case as dramatic as yours have I seen it work. He says, you mean there's a chance?
One in a million, right?
Yeah, one in a million. So Bill Wilson had wrote that this was the first in the chain of events that led to AA. There's a solution. But follow along here. Drop down to 1931. There's a guy by the name of Dr. William Duncan Silkworth. He had lost his butt in the stock market crash of 1929 along with the rest of our country. And he was a neurologist over at Bellevue. And when the stock market crashed, he's out of work. And a guy by the name of Charlie Towns had a hospital in New York City, Towns Hospital. Little sidebar that we just found out here recently. Charlie Towns is actually from Claxton, Georgia. Pretty cool deal, huh?
Homegrown, man. That's good
stuff.
So
Charlie Towns says, well, Silky, why don't you come over here and go to work for me? I've got a little hospital set up studying alcoholism and drug addiction. So he says, I'll be right over. So he went over and he went to work for him in the last part of 1931. Skip forward 2 years, 1933.
One thing to kind of pay attention to, Bud Firestone comes from the Firestone Company, the big company in Akron. So when Bud Firestone, the black sheep of the Firestone family, comes home sober, it was front page news. And the Oxford groups, being a part of and affiliated with that, it was front page news. It was front page news for weeks. It was a huge revival type of atmosphere going on in Akron, Ohio. And so it wasn't just this little clandestine group of people doing this work. It was this very prominent foray into spiritual growth and first century Christianity that was happening in Akron. And the reason I say all that is because if you look at the next part that Larry's about to touch on, it sounds like there's a whole bunch of activity going on, and how all these people got involved is because of the dramatic results of God intervening in Bud Firestone's life.
So Firestone comes back to Akron. See, we've been all over the world now. We're back in Akron with Bud Firestone. And he goes to the Oxford groups and he meets Henrietta Seiberling, a guy by the name of Reverend Walter Tunks, whose picture was just up there, a couple named T. Henry and Claire Ace Williams. And his father, Harvey Firestone, was so excited and so pleased that his son wasn't showing his butt out in the street no more that he threw a party, a big sit-down dinner at the Mayflower Hotel in Akron. Well, if you're much on history, you know what happened at the Mayflower Hotel a little bit later on. Bill Wilson ain't even got to Akron yet, but they're having this party for the Oxford group because they have redeemed his son. So, front page news for weeks, and then about that time, Dr. Bob Smith starts going to the Oxford groups because his wife, Ann, had discovered this group of people that seemed to be happy, to have some direction, to have some responsibility. And
they talked about themselves without any shame.
Yeah. So Bob would do anything to get her to shut up and let him drink. So they start going to the Oxford groups.
That's kind of summarizing it a little bit.
Well, we're giving you cliff notes here today. If you want to get the real deal, stop in on us on Thursday night. Anyway, 1933, Roland Hazard becomes active at Calvary Church back in New York City. And he's working with Shoemaker, a guy by the name of Shep Cornell, a guy named Seber Graves, and Jim Newton. So Roland's sober. Bottom of 33, fall of 33, Bill makes his first trip to Towns Hospital. While he's there, he meets this Dr. Silkworth. And while there, he goes through the belladonna treatment, which keeps him out of going into delirium tremens. And this is his first of four visits. Bob's still going to the Oxford groups. He's active, but he's getting tight every night on the way home.
Well-intentioned.
Yep. He doesn't know. They're teaching him the solution, but he doesn't know what the problem is. I'm a motorhead. I love motorcycles. I like anything that makes loud racket and burns high test gas. And if it starts missing and popping, and I go to my barbershop and say my motorcycle's missing and popping, he's liable to say, well, change your fuel filter. But if I want to know what the problem is, I got to go to the Harley-Davidson store. You follow where I'm going with this? He's going over here and they're telling them the solution, but he doesn't know what the problem is. He doesn't know what he's trying to fix. He thinks he's just a bad moral fiber at this point. Mm-hmm. Middle of 1934. Guy by the name Ebby Thatcher, Edwin Throckmorton Thatcher.
You'd go by Ebby too, wouldn't you?
Ebby is another one of these white-collar industrialist boys. His family owned Throckmorton
Ironworks.
They made railroad wheels, and they donated a park to the city of Albany. I mean, these boys, these are high rollers. All of these people we're talking about so far are high rollers. He's about to be committed for alcoholic insanity. His family had run him off and told him he needed to go up to the Berkshire Mountains to that vacation house and take care of it. And just stay up there because you're an eyesore to our family, Ebby. And he said, fine. He goes up there and he He looked at it and he says, this thing could use a coat of paint. Well, he paints the old house, and he's standing out in the yard musing at his wonderful accomplishment. And about that time, a pigeon come by and took a crap on it. Well, he pulled out a 10-gauge shotgun and started shooting pigeons.
Come on.
Sheriff came by and said, Ebby, we love having you up here, but you can't be discharging a firearm out here in this country. These people, you're scaring the crap out of these people. He said, fine. A few days later, he was in that old car that they kept up there, and he was driving through town and in the morning, and somehow or another lost control of it, and it came embedded in the side of this woman's house and stopped in her kitchen.
It could happen to any of us.
She's sitting there having a bowl of Wheaties. He gets out of the car, kicks the door open, doffs his hat, and says, morning, ma'am. Good morning for a cup of coffee. Well, the sheriff came out there and said, Ebby,
come on,
you got to go. And they took him to jail, and they were about to lock him up for alcoholic insanity. When Roland Hazard, Shep Cornell, and a guy by the name of Seber Graves showed up in Judge Graves, Seber's daddy's courtroom, and said, if you will turn this guy over to us, we think we got something that can help him with his alcoholic problem. So the judge says, well, I hope so. His name was Collins Graves. So they turned Ebby over to these guys, and they took him to Calvary Church and to the Oxford groups, and they told him what the solution was, based in a spiritual sense that they had learned from the Oxford groups. You with us? And they told him about a practical program of action. Ebby, you can get and stay sober through spiritual means, but in order to hang on to it, you have to carry this yet to others. And Ebby scratches his head and he goes, huh. I know just the character. December 11th, 1934, Bill makes his last admission to Towns Hospital. Let me back up. When Ebby decides that he knows somebody to carry the message to, it's Bill Wilson, because Bill was an old schoolmate and they drank together. And he went over and visited Bill. And he told him, he said, Bill, he says, you can get sober through a spiritual means. And he says, I'm bringing this message to you because in order for me to keep it, I have to pass it on. December 11, 34, Bill's last admission to Towns Hospital. And at this point, Bill Wilson is the only person on the planet Earth that knows all three things. I've been doing this for 14 years, and every time I get to this point, every hair on my body stands up. If I had any hair, y'all would see it. Stop it. He knows three things. He's the only one because, see, Silkworth told him. He said, Bill, when you start thinking about drinking, you can't quit, can you? Bill says, nope. He says, and what happens every time is you cave in and you start drinking, and once you start drinking, you can't stop. He says, that's it. He says, you have what I call an obsession of the mind coupled with the allergy of the body. You have a sickness. You have an illness. It wasn't classified a disease until the 50s. So Bill Wilson knows what the problem is. Ebby told him what the solution was, and once he found that solution, how to keep it by carrying it out to yet other alcoholics. Wow. So, about this time, Bill's sober for about 6 months, and he gets a call to go to Akron, Ohio on a proxy takeover for National Rubber Machine Company. And while he's there, the business deal goes through the cracks. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm skipping too far ahead. Bob's still going to Oxford groups with Tunks and Henrietta and his wife, Ann.
We've searched the web, and this is about the most acceptable picture we can find of Henrietta. We got another one that'll... What's the old saying?
She's so ugly, she has to beat her feet to make them sleep with her. That's an ugly woman. I'm sorry. I mean,
this is a picture of T. Henry and Clarice Williams. Their home was where the Oxford groupers met. Actually, the alcoholic squad of the Oxford group in Akron, Ohio. And before AA split off and started meeting in the King School in Akron, this is where all the magic happened.
And what happened is they in the Oxford groups, they started praying for manna from heaven for Bob because he finally admitted that he had a drinking problem. And they started praying. And about that time, Bill ends up going to Akron. But just before his visit to Akron, he went back to the hospital and he told Silkworth, he says, you know, this deal ain't working. He says, ain't nobody getting sober but me, about 6 months. And Bill said, Silkworth said, Bill, quit going into them bar rooms and them Boweries and them alleyways beating them drunks over the head with the Bible. Drunks won't put up with that. Tell those people what I told you, Bill. Tell them about the obsession of the mind and the obsession of the phenomenon of craving. It's an allergy. Tell them what I told you, Bill. He goes to Akron on this proxy bid deal, and it falls through, and he's pacing about the Mayflower Hotel lobby. And he knows the only thing that's going to work is what he's been doing. He's got to work with another drunk, but he's in a strange town. He goes over to the hotel directory of churches, and he went straight to one name. I know if you watch the movie, My Name is Bill W. He went to one name. He went to Walter Tunks. Just so happened, Walter Tunks was a member of the Oxford groups. So was Bill. And the reason he chose that name is because in the Great Northeast, when he and Lois would walk out in through the woods and stuff, they would call it going for a tunk. To take a tunk means to go for a walk, and he picked that name on that basis. And Tunk says, I got somebody that I can hook you up with, and he hooked him up with Henrietta, and she says, boy, we've been praying for you to show up. I got just the character. I got a proctologist that's in bad shape. That was the day before Mother's Day.
Let me ask you a question. If somebody calls you up and says, I'm a friend of Bill's, my experience is I know everything I need to know about that person just by that statement. Bill did the same thing, but a little different with Henrietta. I'm a rum hound from New York, and I'm a member of the Oxford groups. Well, so am I. I'm an Oxford grouper, too. Yeah, I need to talk to a drunk. Wow, I got a drunk you need to talk to. You know what? Let's put these two together. And it's just because it all, man, so much. And Larry's going to point this out in a second, but it's so neat to see the fingerprints of God all over this.
So he goes, he calls over there, and Dr. Smith has been on a binge, and he says, I'm sick. He says, maybe tomorrow. So on May the 12th of 1935, they're driving over to the Cyberling Mansion, and they're going to meet in the gatehouse. And he told Ann, he says, when we get there, he says, you got to promise me that after 15 minutes you'll come and get me. He says, I'm sick, Ann. I'm going to give this guy 15 minutes. She says, I'll do whatever you want me to do, Bob. And here's the way that deal took place. He walked into that gatehouse, and he was shaking. He was sick. And he stuck his trembling hand across the table, and he says, Mr. Wilson, he says, I don't know what you think you can do for me. He says, I've been prayed over and carved up more than a Christmas goose. Bill looked him straight in the eye, and he says, I'm not here for you, Dr. Smith. I'm here for me. The 15-minute conversation went for 5.5 hours. It's a byproduct. Here we are. What I would invite you to do when you leave today, take out any date, any person, or any place, or any of these events. And we're not here today. What I choose to believe is that this timeline is divinely inspired. God started in 1907 to hook us all up. Because if he'd have thrown us all together, we'd have just burned it to the ground. Because that's the way we do stuff. All right. I bet you a bunch of y'all didn't bring your big books, did you? Mm-hmm. You ain't going to need them.
Yeah, we're going to be taking a break in about 15 minutes or so, and then we're going to be going through two different aspects, Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith. We're going to do Bill first, because Bill liked to be first.
A little thing that you may or may not know about Bill. As a young, he comes from a long line of alcoholics, grandpa, daddy, and they were a disgrace. And he was warned early on that he may have this genetic defect.
They didn't know it was a genetic defect at that point.
Yeah, but they told him, you may have this bug, and there may be a problem later on, and we need you to be aware of that. And he just turned a deaf ear to it. And what happened is Father Gilman had left, his mama left, and we're going to go over this in a second. But the point that we're going to try and establish with you is that Bill Wilson and his sister both felt as though they didn't measure up, that they had been thrown away by the people that loved them the most. The father left, and the very next day, mama left. And Bill became an overachiever. Everything that he did, he had to be first. He had to overdo it. And that's where this thing's going to start. He was, Bill drank for 20 years. How long did Bob drink?
32, roughly. And by the way, we're going to throw around dates, facts, names, locations. If you type in the words Alcoholics Anonymous in Google, I think the last was like 2 million plus pages of facts, figures, and you could find just about anything you want to dispute any aspect of what we're sharing.
So you can figure out what we do in our spare time. We're really boring.
But 50 cents in the information we're sharing with you will get you a cup of coffee at Waffle House. It won't keep you sober for a minute. What it will do, and I know the experience he had is the same I had, they suddenly stopped being names on a page and they became figures in history. They became real people. You know, I was telling Buddy this before the meeting. I'm so grateful that Bill Wilson was fallible. Because if he sat on a pedestal that I could never reach, I'll never measure up. Boy, that sounds a lot like my life before I got sober. I'm never going to measure up. But what we found out is through their human failings, that part in how it works where it says, you know, what an order, I can't go through with it. Don't be discouraged. Not even Bill Wilson or Bob could maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. They're not saints.
Bill was born November the 26th of 1895. He was actually born behind a bar.
Good place.
In East Dorset, Vermont.
They actually leave the room behind the bar. There's a light, and I've heard this, maybe it's mythology, I don't know, but I've heard the story that they leave the light on all the time in that room. Just one little light on the wall. Just as a remembrance.
It's probably glowing from his presence. But
yeah.
He was abandoned by his father, Gilman Gilly Wilson, as a child. Bill's mother, Emily, left the next day to go to Boston to study osteopathic medicine. Her parents, Fayette and Ella Griffith, raised Bill and his sister, Dorothy. Mm. Fayette became Bill's hero. He hung on his every word, and his grandfather would challenge him to do certain things, and Bill would over excel to make these things happen. And I know if you're an alcoholic, you get it. I mean, I want mine to be the fastest, the prettiest, the shiniest, the sweetest, all of that stuff. And so Bill became an overachiever. His grandfather told him one time, he said, you know, Bill, the only people that can really make a boomerang and fly it successfully are the bushmen from Australia. Hmm. Bill says something like we'd say down here in the South, watch this. He went and took the cherry headboard from his bed, and he spent the better part of a year carving it and carving it and carving it. And at the end of that tedious work, he came out with a beautiful cherry boomerang. He says, hey, Grandpa, come out here and look at this. And he flipped it, and it came back and damn near killed both of them.
And Larry paints this image that, like, he spent a year carving one boomerang. No. He had a lot of test cases, and they
all
failed.
Well, it was a headboard, for crying out loud.
But the thing that's neat to note, noteworthy about the story, it's not so much that he did it. It's just that he didn't give up. He had every reason in the world to not, because it would throw it and it just kept going, you know. And
all he was trying to do is get you to recognize that he was worthy.
Yeah.
That was his whole. And so, after doing this, his grandfather gave him the nickname as the number one man. And Bill's going, yeah, buddy.
Yeah.
That's me.
And that actually held more recognition for Bill. I don't know if anybody can relate to this. I was one of those that had great intentions, great motives. Once I secured your approval, well, I got to find something else to do now. You know, just accomplishing my goal wasn't enough. You needed to know that I accomplished my goal. And I did it, by the way, in a way that nobody had ever thought of doing it before. in a shinier, faster, more progressive way. And, of course, nobody's ever going to be able to do it like I did. Of course, that's all up here, right?
So Bill, he becomes, listen to some of these accomplishments. He's playing first violin in the orchestra.
Second, just won't do.
No. He became president of the senior class. Don't come over here starting nothing. He became a star football player. He became a star pitcher and a captain of the baseball team. Think Bill's an overachiever?
Mm-hmm.
Ebbie Thatcher, his old buddy, went to school with Bill and became his future drinking buddy. They were at Burton and Burr Seminary up in Manchester, Vermont. While in school, Bill fell in love with this young girl named Bertha Bamford. And, you know, that first love deal. I mean, it was true love. And Bertha went in for a routine surgery and died on the table from a hemorrhage. Bill's in Burton and Burr, and over the intercom system, they announced that Bertha Bamford has died in the OR. That's how Bill found out about her death. Bill failed out of school in 3 months. Depression set in on him, and he never overcame it. And he battled depression for the rest of his natural-born life. His grades, sports, everything. It wasn't 3 months. I'm sorry. It was 2 months.
So what's the best way to pick up a forlorn lover?
Find another.
Lois Burnham. She was older, smarter, bluer blood. Her daddy, Clark Burnham, was a doctor. And they vacationed at Emerald Lake right up the street from where Bill lived. And Bill knew he would never measure up. He just knew it. And she kind of thought he was awkward. Her daddy thought he was weird. He was that guy always trying to sell stuff, you know. But he just kept wearing her down, and taking long walks and spending quality time with her and challenging her. You know, and being what Bill Wilson was. He was a great guy. He was fun to be around.
But
she fell madly in love with him.
And one thing to remember, when she met Bill, she was warned by his family that there was a drinking problem within that Wilson family, and she needed to kind of watch it.
Yeah.
So they get married just before he ships out to go to England for the big WW1. Y'all want a break for 10? And we'll wrap it up when y'all come back.
It's going to be kind of whirlwind. We've been told that we get a little enthusiastic. Sorry. Just deal with it, you know. You know, enthusiasm is actually worse than a common cold. Because it's very contagious, and you'll see people, you'll just wear them down. We'll be up there just hooting, hollering, and just having a grand old time, and somebody say, this ain't a pep rally, and I'm like, yes, it is. This is a pep rally, because if you ain't excited about this thing, what are you telling the new guy? Even in the middle of chaos.
If you want to see enthusiasm, talk to Tommy after we're done. Yeah. She's got 48 years, and she'll whoop you up.
There you go.
All right, listen. Okay, Bill Wilson, we've talked about his childhood. Bill decides he's going to join the Army and go overseas and fight WW1.
That's what he looked like when he left. He didn't look like that when he came back, but that's what he looked like when he left.
So keeping in mind his family's told him about the strong prejudices of drink within the Wilson family. He's kind of like, yeah, whatever. And it says, in the book, it says war fever ran high. And when he joined the Army, he says, I was part of life at last. And in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. We find that to be a very alcoholic statement. Most people have their first drink. Bill discovered liquor. And, you know, he had his first drink, and it took off from there. And Lois was warned about his drinking, and she started monitoring it. And it says over in England, he said he was very lonely and again turned to alcohol, kind of a timeline on the progression. And it says they landed in England, and he visited Winchester Cathedral. And the book says, much moved. Something profound happened to Bill Wilson in that cathedral. Keeping in mind the war was in France. But on the Lancashire, the battleship that they were, or the troop ship that they were on going over, they could hear the artillery fire and the mines going off in the ocean. And Bill actually pulled his sidearm in the belly of that ship and fired it a couple of times to get the troops calmed down because there was a possible mutiny at hand. So he wandered outside and he caught this, he saw this tombstone of Thomas Fetcher that was in the graveyard outside of Winchester. And he says, good soldiers near forgot whether he dieth by musket or by pot. Ominous warning which I failed to heed. Ominous is threatening. Mm-hmm. And he goes on to say, 22 and a veteran of foreign wars. I went home at last. I fancied myself a leader, for had not the men of my battery given me a token of appreciation, probably a bottle of scotch. And he had earned their respect probably by firing off that sidearm in the belly of that ship. Now keep in mind, he says, a veteran of foreign wars. Bill never saw any action. There was an epidemic that kept them behind the front lines. He never fired a gun. Veteran of foreign wars.
You know, there's a line in the book where it talks about, we enjoyed a certain reputation, but we knew in our heart we didn't deserve it. Bill wrestled with that because he was given the opportunity when he was in military academy, as he was becoming an officer, even before he stepped off native soil, he was given the opportunity to be in a position of command. What did he choose? The Marine battalion back at the bay, not going to the front line, not going and leading men into the heart of battle, staying behind and defending our backside. And he never really saw anything go on. And that really ate at him for years, because he would tell you that he was a veteran of World War I and that he was he'd made this world safe for democracy. And he did. He knew in his heart he didn't deserve that recognition.
He says, my talent for leadership, I imagined, would place me at the head of vast enterprises. Bill's going straight from being a army guy to running IBM. This is the way his mind ran, which I would manage with utmost assurance. This boy's got some ego, hadn't he? God, you got to love Bill. So he comes home and he's trying to decide what he wants to do with himself because he's an overachiever. Well, he loved Thomas Edison. He was one of his heroes. He was a chemist. He was a scientist. He was a man with a great mind. So he decided he's going to go to work for Edison, but the guidelines and the hoops he had to jump through to get hooked up with Edison were pretty stringent, and he passed them all with assurance. And he went to meet Edison, and Edison says, I'm going to give you a job. He says, thanks, but no thanks. There's only going to be one Thomas Edison, and you're it, not me. Turn Thomas Edison down.
Unless, it'd be cool if it were to call it like Wilson Electric. You know, I'm sure he would have like signed on then.
And then he decided he wanted to be an attorney, so he went to Brooklyn Law School, stayed drunk throughout that whole thing, but graduated. Wasn't good enough. He never went and picked up his diploma.
Mm-hmm.
Bill's a trip. So he gets this idea from Ebby about stock speculation and working on Wall Street. He loved the whirlwind and the maelstrom of Wall Street. And he got this idea. Bill is a real forward thinker, that if he could go out and get inside information about companies that were on the stock market, General Electric, Westinghouse, Portland Cement, Pennick and Ford, these different investment deals, if he could get the inside information of what they were putting together in their research and development departments, and they could pass that on to potential buyers, they could make a more informed purchase.
Bill's forward thinking is actually against the law today.
insider trading. Yeah. But he went to Frank Shaw and different firms, and he said, look, I'm thinking about going out and investigating these manufacturing firms and giving y'all some feedback. And they said, you're out of your mind. No, thank you. So he says, well, the heck with you. And he went and bought a 1919 Harley-Davidson motorcycle with a sidecar. And he and Lois got on that thing, and they packed it with several references of Moody's Financial Reference, big, thick journals like that, and all these heavy clothing, keeping in mind, roads were not like they are today. There were very few paved roads. And this is probably the most undependable machine that God ever gave breath to.
It's a Harley, so come on. Come on, be nice. It's a Harley.
Every now and then I have to do this. They didn't make Hondas back then. Anyway, they took off out of the Northeast, out of New York, and they were on this motorcycle for a year. They camped out, and they did all these different things. And what they did is Bill would grease the wheel by having a few drinks with the guys in the research and development department and get into these places. If you saw My Name is Bill W., you've got some ideas of that. And he would call back to Wall Street giving them these reports of things that, you know, talking movies and radios that would talk overseas and all this stuff. And all of a sudden, his idea became a success. Very forward thinker. So, let's see here. They were gone for a year. And all of a sudden, these ideas procured him a place on Wall Street. And a big stock option. So at this point, Bill Wilson has arrived. This is exactly what he's looking for. They went and they started looking at apartments in Manhattan. And if you've got your finger on the pulse of what that city is like, a sumptuous apartment meant that he rented two. One wasn't big enough for he and Lois. They rented two and tore the wall out between them and made this one huge apartment. And in today's standards, Bill would probably be classified as a millionaire. They were very, very, very well off. And then the stock market crash took place on October 29th, Black Tuesday. Bill's $645,000 in debt by today's standards. And he lost it all.
Anybody ever run a tab at a bar? Or get something on credit, so to speak? And then they look for you and you can't re-up? The bartender was always mine. That was a challenge because, see, they were cool through the week. I was the kitchen manager. They were okay during the week. Saturday and Sunday came around, they were looking for, you need to pay up. Well, darn it. I'm going to have to get you next week, you know? Bill bought on a tab when it came to stocks. He bought on margin. He didn't have to put anything down for it. And when the stock market crash happened, and I know there's probably people in this room who've felt the pinch of what's happened in the last 6 months. It's painful, isn't it? And I know I have. I've watched my 401k cut in half. And I'm 36, but I'm already feeling the pinch. And friends of mine have lost their jobs. When this happened, I mean, it was catastrophic what happened. And their bill, everything was lost.
They had a reverse effect in Canada, though. When our stock market crashed, theirs boomed. So he had a guy by the name of Dick Johnson that was a buddy of his in Montreal, and he calls Dick up, and Dick says, yeah, come on and go to work for me, because Bill was a legend in his field. And he goes to Montreal, and all of a sudden, he's back. He's dog broke. But once he gets there, he's only there for a few months, and he's back living, looking, you know, he's got this sumptuous apartment up there. But guess what? Liquor caught up with him, and Dick had to fire him. So the progression of Bill's disease has got him by the short hairs at this point. And they've got this, I don't know about how many of y'all have them, but in my family, we had an old family Bible that sat in the vestibule of our house. And it sat in a prominent place, and Mama would put that little ribbon marker, and it had that red writing in there, and she would change the pages as though we were going to walk by and read it. But Bill would write all these sweet promises to Lois. June 6th, 1931. So help me God, Lois. My love for you is strong enough. This is it. No more drinking. And it was throughout the Bible, and it got to the point to where Bill would prick his finger and write his promises in blood. He did that a lot. I mean, it was dozens and dozens of promises, which we know he broke a lot. And keeping in mind that his mother and father had abandoned them, He absolutely loved Lois's mother. And Bill's in the grips of big-time alcoholism. He's no longer drinking because he wants to. He's drinking because he has to. And she died. Bill was so drunk he couldn't attend the funeral. And it was a crushing blow to him and her family, obviously. Bill makes his first visit to Towns Hospital in the fall of 33. He goes through this belladonna treatment, which keeps him out of DTs. It's a mild sedative. And they did something back that they used to do back then called hydrotherapy, where they would strap him down in 4 points of restraints and run him through this wall that was tile walls, ceilings, and floors with alternating hot and cold shower heads. Hot and cold, and they'd run him down through there on that gurney. At the end of it, what you got was a real clean drunk. Didn't do anything for the drinking deal. July of 34, Bill makes his second visit to Towns. And Silkworth tells him about the disease concept, the obsession of the mind coupled with the allergy of the body. Page 8 of the book, Bill says, "No words can tell of the loneliness and despair that I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I'd met my match. I'd been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master." We consider that to be Bill's first step experience. But it wasn't enough, obviously. On Armistice Day, 1934, Bill's feeling pretty good. He hadn't had a drink in a minute. And he thinks, well, I'm going to go out and play 18 holes. His brother-in-law, Dr. Strong, had a membership at this exclusive course, and he borrowed a set of clubs from the good doctor, and he got on a bus. He's headed out to the club on Armistice Day to play around. Well, this guy gets on the bus carrying a gun in a case. Could you imagine what it'd be like today to get on a bus with a gun? Anyway, Bill probably said something like, "Where are you going with that gun?" The guy says, "Well, I'm an expert rifleman and sharpshooter, and I've got a shooting competition out at the country club today." Bill says, "Well, that's where I'm going. I'm going out to play 18 holes." During this conversation, Bill tells the guy about his moral fiber, how strong he is because he's alcoholic, crushed, lost it all, made it back, lost it all, and now he's sober. The guy says, "Man." He says, "You're made up of some incredible moral fiber, dude. You're one heck of a man." And Bill said, "Yes, I am." Bill loved it when people would tell him that he was the man. Well, the bus breaks down. They go in this coffee shop, get a cup of coffee. But another bus comes. They get on the bus. They go back to the country club. They get there a little early. The guy says, "Well, you know, my competition doesn't start for an hour." Bill says, "Well, my tea time's not for an hour. Why don't we grab a sandwich?" They go to the restaurant. Restaurant's closed. Groundskeeper says, "Go around to the pro shop and get a sandwich in there." Well, they walked in. As soon as they walked in the door, the bartender goes, "Happy Armistice Day, boys. These are on the house." Bill took the drink, and the guy says, "You idiot. You just told me what a powerful man you were." So he was off again. Not long after that, Ebby visits Bill. And he does. If you read the book says that he visited Bill. Well, he actually visited Bill about four times. And when he walked in there, he says, "I've got religion." Ebby says, "Get out of my house." And he kept throwing him out. And Ebby kept coming back with different members of the Oxford groups. They finally ended up bringing in Roland Hazard. They called him the closer. And so they tried to evangelize Bill, and Bill starts wrestling in his head. If you read Bill's story, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth about his teachings from his grandfather and all the prejudices that he had about spiritual logic. And then Ebby suggested something that absolutely was the deal breaker. There was no argument about. He said, "Bill, why don't you choose your own conception of God? You can't argue with that." Bill said, "Hmm." He says, "That statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered for many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. Step two, it was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required for me to make a beginning. So Bill all of a sudden believes that there's something more powerful than him, which is a big deal for him. Bill keeps referring to that day in Winchester Cathedral. If you pick up the copy of Pass It On, the story of Bill Wilson and how the AA message reached the world, it says an epidemic, on page 60, it says an epidemic kept Bill and his regiment detained at a camp near Winchester, depressed and lonely and apprehensive about what lay ahead. There's no war, y'all. He's in England. The war's happening in France. In his head, he could hear the gunfire and the grenades and the artillery. This is in Bill's head. Great thinker. What lay ahead, Bill went into Winchester Cathedral. Inside the great cathedral, the atmosphere impressed itself so deeply upon him that he was taken by a sort of ecstasy, moved and stirred by a tremendous sense of presence. I have been in many cathedrals since and have never experienced anything like it, he said. Here's the key. For a brief moment, I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have him with me, and he came. In that moment, Bill knew that everything was all right, as it should be. So before Ebby came to visit him, he's in WW1, he's scared. You know that foxhole prayer? He went seeking something, and God showed up. He asked God, he said, God, if you're here, please show yourself to me. And God made a very profound appearance in Bill Wilson's life. He makes his fourth visit to Towns Hospital on December 11th, 1934. That's the date of his last drink. And somewhere in that time period, within a few days, Ebby comes and visits Bill. You want to go over that?
Oh, sure. Top of page 13. It's the most profound page in Bill's story in my experience. Bill Wilson was about 4 days. Can anybody remember 4 days? 4 days without a drink. Remember how open and willing you were to feel any different than you were? Bill summarizes it in one page. And I've since spoken with a number of people here. Bill really kind of took liberty with his story. And I want to dig in more on this to learn more about how this transpired, the experience that Bill Wilson and Ebby Thatcher had doing the original six tenets of the Oxford Groups. But he elaborates on a certain extent. He talks about, there I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him to do with me as he would.
That's the third step.
I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins, and I became willing to have my newfound friend take them away root and branch.
That's steps 4, 6, and 7.
He says, I haven't had a drink since. I like the fact that he talks about root and branch. You know, it's that old analogy, sober up a drunken horse thief, what do you got? Sober horse thief. Root and branch. Root of the selfishness, self-centeredness, self-seeking. And so well poetically written in how it works, the fifth chapter. But he talks about that root and branch. That's a big deal. Because if it just took away the branch, I can mask over. I can act good. But I'm still full-blown alcoholic. And then nothing changed. And he says, my schoolmate visited me. And I fully acquainted Ebby with my problems and deficiencies.
Step 5.
Ebby and I made a list of people I had hurt.
Step 8.
Or towards whom I felt resentment. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to write all such matters to the utmost of my ability.
Step 9.
I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness
Step
within.
10.
Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt.
Step 11.
Asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself except as my requests bore on my usefulness to others.
So that step, he did all 11 steps, bada bing, bada boom. You know, there are people in the fellowship saying, don't rush into taking these steps. Take your time. Easy does it. I want what the first 100 got. I don't know about y'all. And when I read what they did, their timeline is next, launched immediately. Those are the timelines the book gives. It doesn't say anything about waiting a year. The timeline's not in here. And I'm not going to go off on that tirade. And then the first part of the 12th step says, my friend promised that when these things were done, I would enter into a new relationship with my Creator. And he says, while I lay in the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been given so freely to me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, would work with others. Second part of the 12th step, first thought of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's just coming out of DTs. Third part of the 12th step, my friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Okay?
These are just some extra pictures that we have of Bill and Lois. And Bill and the guy on the bed. Not sure who the guy was in that one particular picture, but he looked receptive. He was smiling.
And Bill dies on January 24th, 1971. That's one of your co-founders, the late, great Bill Wilson. And then we got another kind of drinker over here.
Robert Holbrook Smith.
Looks kind of like Paul Newman there, doesn't he?
Alcohol took its toll on him, though. He ended up looking like that. But he started out promising.
He was born August 8th of 1879. He drank for 32 years. A lot longer than Bill, almost twice as long. He was an only child. Didn't do any drinking until he got to college. He was the son of a judge. And quite a character from what I understand, all except that his father was an alcoholic. He went to Dartmouth in 1898. He met Ann Ripley in that year and eventually married after 17-year courtship.
That's an investment.
Let's don't rush into taking these things, you know what I'm saying? You know, Bob, that was Bob's deal.
Yeah, part of that dough was his going to school, and, you know, it took him that much longer to go to school.
You know, he's the one that coined Easy Does It.
Yeah.
He graduated Dartmouth in 1902, and what we have learned is that Dartmouth had the drinkingest school of the Ivy League. Them boys love to drink.
Yeah.
And then for a while, he sold heavy hardware for a few years up in Boston. Skip forward to 1905, he entered the University of Michigan at 26 years old. And in 1907, because of his drinking, he left the University of Michigan and took a geographical cure. Fall of 07.
Didn't last that long.
Yeah.
Till the fall.
Yeah. He was able to take his finals, and he went to Rush Medical College. Drinking was so bad at Rush, his drinking buddies of the fraternity sent for his daddy to come and intervene on him. Y'all know what those little interventions from Mom and Daddy did. Fine, sure. Got it. Get right on that. So we know what that did. His daddy came and threatened him and all that business. So in 1910, at age 31, he graduated with high marks from Rush, got a degree for proctology. Condition was that he had to remain absolutely dry. Doesn't say anything about sober. Then he opened a practice in Akron, Ohio.
Bought himself a little house on 855 Ardmore Avenue. And anybody's ever been up to Founders Day lovingly knows the exterior of that home.
He accepts voluntary incarceration at local sanitariums over 12 times that year.
Now, it sounded like everything was going great. Opened up his own practice, proctologist of town. You know, you could be known for certain things, I guess, but, you know, he was the butt doctor. And one of the things that he did after having this loving relationship with his wife, they bought a house, you know. They had a family. Alcoholism rears its ugly head, and that's a tough spot to be in. You know, when he voluntarily incarcerated himself a dozen times at a local sanitarium. This isn't Peachford or Ridgeview. This is one of those where you hear the loud clang of the doors behind you. I mean, this is not the day room. Identification going on in here.
I mean,
the day room.
You know, it's got to be pretty bad when you walk up and you hand them your car keys and all your Valium and everything and say, look, guys, I need y'all to lock me down for a couple weeks.
Yeah.
And he does that a dozen times. I mean, hello.
One of my favorite speakers talks about handcuffs. You know, it's the same type of situation, but handcuffs are what is like a temporary and minor inconvenience. You know, when you accept voluntary commitment, and I've been in that place. It's a tough spot to be in, you know, with the room with no door handle on it, because you really want to go somewhere other than where you're at. You can't. A dozen times. Well, he had a little bit more willingness than I did.
Come over to 175 and read the bottom of that, will you?
Bob's my kind of alcoholic. He didn't make a fuss. He just kind of tried to keep his alcoholism below the radar. But he mentions a whole bunch of things that were, and I can relate to them. He talks about these phobias that he developed. One of them was the fear of not sleeping.
Guess what you got to do to sleep.
Yeah. And the other was the fear of running out of liquor.
Ooh.
Now, tell me if this makes you tired, just thinking about it. Not being a man of means, which basically means he wasn't making a lot of money yet, I knew that if I did not stay sober enough to earn money, I would run out of liquor. So therefore, most of the time, I did not take the morning drink, which I craved so badly, but instead I would fill up on doses of outside of issues. They use sedatives, but we're going to use outside issues, to quiet the jitters, which distressed me terribly. Now, occasionally I would yield to the morning craving. If I did, it would be only a few hours before I would be quite, he uses the word, unfit. I like to think sloshed, tore up from the floor up, unfit for work. This would lessen my chances of smuggling some home that evening, which in turn would mean a night of futile tossing around in a bed, followed by the morning of unbearable jitters. During the subsequent, here's willpower, 15 years, I had sense enough never to go to the hospital if I had been drinking, and very seldom did I receive patients. He's a good guy. You know, he knew that if he had been drinking, he couldn't work.
But, how many of y'all have tried the experiment of setting your clock? I'm only going to drink after, I'm only going to drink no more than, you ever done that?
Yeah.
All right. For the benefit of those experimentally inclined, I should mention the so-called beer experiment. Because this is during Prohibition, right? He says, when beer first came back, I thought that I was safe.
Back.
I thought I could drink all I wanted of that. It was harmless. Nobody ever got drunk on beer. So I filled the cellar. He didn't go out and buy a six-pack. He filled the cellar. Full. With the permission of my good wife, God love her, it was not long before I was drinking at least a case and a half a day. Yeah, that's my guy.
This ain't the regulated beer either.
This ain't
6 or 7% alcohol. This is
the, back then you drink one of those, it's like doing a couple of shots of vodka. It says, I put on 30 pounds of weight in about 2 months. I looked like a pig and was uncomfortable from shortness of breath. Then it occurred to me that once one was all smelled up with beer, nobody could tell what had been drunk, so I began to fortify my beer with straight alcohol. I like this guy.
He's an experimenter, there you know, scientific to the core.
And he says, of course, the result was very bad, and that ended the beer experiment. So Bob's a character. January of 33, this is when Ann says, listen, I've met this group of people that seem to be, says, about the time of the beer experiment, I was thrown in with a crowd of people who attracted me because of their seeming poise, health, and happiness. They spoke with great freedom from embarrassment, which I could never do. And they seemed very much at ease on all occasions and appeared very healthy. More than these attributes, they seemed to be happy. And so they attracted him.
How many people have had the experience early on in AA, you would sit in a meeting and you would hear somebody share candidly about something that they did, and you were amazed that they would admit that in a meeting? Now, there's a fine line between being honest and the fifth step, and we all know that. But you'll hear these things about being scared about going and facing somebody. God, I would my feeling when I came in here was I would never admit that publicly. But these Oxford groupers were talking about their womanizing, their gambling, their overeating, their whatever it was, whatever sin was taking them out of contact with God, they would talk about it. And Bob was like, I'm not talking about my stuff like that. But these people were able to do it, free of embarrassment, shared poise and grace. They did it with an air of dignity. How do they do that? So what was attractive was the freedom that they felt. You know, Larry introduces himself quite often as, you know, I'm Larry Scott, I'm free tonight. There's some people in the meetings who will not understand what that means. That's who we're trying to reach. Those who don't understand what it means to be free. All that Bob knew is these people were not bound by their behaviors, by their fears, by their failures. They weren't bound with the selfishness. They had found something. And what an attractive quality. What an example to be able to share to somebody. Because if this just isn't about not drinking, or is it so much more, you know? And we get a little impassioned about these things, but that's what attracted Bob and Bill to the Oxford group to get into where we're sitting here today. You know, it's such a big development that came about.
So the Oxford groupers attracted Bob, not as much as they attracted Ann, because that's the life that they were exhibiting was the life that Ann wanted. She was married to a prominent physician. She'd been with him for a lot of years. And he was a complete disgrace. He could not quit drinking. Didn't mean that he was a bad moral fiber. It's just that when he started drinking, he couldn't stop.
Yeah, but he thought he was a bad moral fiber.
So on May the 12th of 34, Bill Wilson comes to Akron, and we'd already talked about that, and they met. And so Bill decides he's going to stay in Akron for a little while and live with Bob and Ann. Lois wasn't too crazy about that, but he did. Comes somewhere early June, there is an American Medical Association conference in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Keep in mind, Bob hadn't been sober a month. He starts packing his bag. He's going to Atlantic City, and Bill and Ann said, Bob, we don't think that's a good idea. He says, I don't care what you think. He said, I've been going to this conference for years, and this ain't going to be no different. He went to the train depot. He got on the train. He drank all the scotch they had on the train on the way up there. He got to Atlantic City. He drank all the scotch they had in the hotel. He got back on the train and came back to Akron. He drank all the scotch they had on the train on the way back. This was on June the 9th. He had an important surgery the next morning on June 10th at 10 o'clock in the morning. And Dr. Bob's nurse called from a nearby town and said, y'all need to come get him. He's over here soused. And y'all got to get him sobered up because he's got a very important surgery in the morning. So Ann and Bill Wilson drove over to the nurse's house and got Bob and got him home and gave him a couple of bottles of beer to settle him down. June 10th, 1935, Bob got up. They gave him a couple of bottles of beer and what the book calls a goofball. We traced that down, and it's an old sedative called a Milltown, and I've had one. Mild sedative my butt. I guarantee you it'll fix what ails you. They gave him two bottles of beer and a goofball. And what a lot of people glaze over, Bill Wilson gave Dr. Bob his last drink, which I think to be real cool. But he went in that morning and he performed that surgery. And to the best of our knowledge, there's nobody walking around with a deformity of their butt. So it must have been a successful surgery. The book, over in the forward to the second, bottom of page XVI, it says, talking about Bob, it says he sobered never to drink again up to the time of his death in 1950. This was during the meeting in May. It's not quite true because he drank again after May, and he drank again in June. So the founding date of Alcoholics Anonymous, And Dr. Bob Smith's birthday is June 10th, 1935. A lot of people, and I'm just repeating what the book says. My sobriety date is December 31st, 1987. I was drunk as a coot on that day. It's not the date after your last drink. It's the date of your last drink. So that's the founding. And usually when we do this at book studies all over the place, somebody goes, I just got a day.
Yeah, Bill talks in the writing, you know, Bill and Bob, they kind of comment on that day, June 10th. And it started off like most days in most of our lives. Hungover, hurting. Bill gives Bob a couple drinks, goes in. You know, we used to think, you know, who gave more to the breakfast, the chicken or the pig? Well, the pig, obviously, right? You know, who gave more to this equation? That unfortunate soul laying on that table dealing with a shaky Dr. Bob as he's doing rectal surgery on him. But in Vision for You, it talks about that what happened afterwards. You know, it says that Bob took the bull by the horns and set out to tell those that he feared what his troubles had been. But Bob found himself surprisingly well-received, and he learned that many knew of his drinking. How many people had that experience? You know, you go and you make an amends to somebody, and they're like, oh, I knew about your drinking. You're like, wow, how'd they know? But check this out. This is how cool it was. You know, you hear that question, how free do you want to be? Are you willing really to go to any lengths? Here are our examples. It says, stepping from into his car, he made the rounds of people he had hurt. He trembled as he went about, for this might mean ruin, particularly for a proctologist or a physician in this town. At midnight, he came exhausted and happy. He has not had a drink since. He went around in one day, faced everybody he could in that town, and told him the truth about himself.
And after he got out of the hospital that morning, he didn't come home. They didn't hear from him, Bill and Ann. And they knew he was out drunk because the obsession had set in, or the allergy had set in, because Bill had given him some drinks that morning.
Yeah.
But that's not true. He did that surgery and went out and made all of his amends. Bob was known as the silent partner of this deal. Bill Wilson was the carnival barker, the forever salesman. Had it been left up to him, he would have franchised it to, and it would not be in existence today. He'd have sold AA. If it had been left up to Bob, Bob would have kept it so tight that probably never ever left the city limits of Akron. Bob carried the AA message to over 5,000 men and women while working with Sister Ignatia at St. Thomas Hospital.
What, 5,000? He only sober and alive after Bill and Bob's meeting for 15 years. 5,000. He actually worked with 5,000. He didn't speak because he wasn't the speaker. Bill was. Bill was the step right up guy. We got what ails you. Come on. Bob was the quiet one behind the scenes in the trenches.
Yeah.
Working with multiple drunks at the same time. Four or five new guys would come into Akron City Hospital or St. Thomas with Sister Ignatia. He'd bring them over to his house and hit your knees. We're going to do this prayer. We're going to commit to this work and we're going to recover. And they would do it rapidly, three or four or five at a time. In one day, he would have them all past an inventory process and into making amends. He took his own example and led by that. And what a great example for us to aspire to.
Yeah.
You know? They didn't sit around and wait till he felt like it, you know. I'm so grateful my first sponsor didn't ask me to join a gym and then sit in the lobby for the first 6 months and find out if I felt like getting on one of the machines, I could do it, you know. I would have left, you know. And I'm so grateful to the people who approached me and approached, you know, I know Larry's experience is abundantly the same. They didn't invite us to sit around and get comfortable. Because anybody untreated alcoholism, how comfortable are you? You know, when I came through the doors, I was looking for something. He talks about things, you know, Bill and Bob both have their strengths, and Bob uses this amazing language. At the end of his story, he encompasses what it is to be recovered. No longer be a slave, no longer be driven, no longer to be controlled, you know. Bill talks about that bitter morass of self-pity, alcohol was my master. Bob actually talks about it, the most beautiful aspect of recovery, and it's very apropos for this day and age. He says, it is the most wonderful blessing to be relieved of the terrible curse with which I was afflicted. My health is good, and I have regained my, wow, self-respect. Who would have thought you can actually get your self-respect back? And the respect of my colleagues. My home life is ideal, and my business is as good as can be expected in these uncertain times.
Sounds like the definition of recovered.
I spend a great deal of time passing on what I learned to others who want and need it badly. He caveats it. Not for those who have the disease, but for those who want and need it. You ever tried to take one of these big books and shove it up somebody's? Mm-hmm. It doesn't fit. You come across as a preacher. You come across as evangelist or a reformer, and you're upset because you can always tell an alcoholic. You just can't tell him much. But he does this for four reasons to those who want and need it badly. Number one, it's a sense of duty. Number two, it's a pleasure. If this wasn't fun, I wouldn't be doing it. If this one, working with others, wasn't fun, I wouldn't do it. Number three, because in so doing this, I am paying my debt to the person who took time to pass it on to me. I'm paying it forward. And number four, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against any possible slip.
And to summarize, Bob says if you think you're an atheist, an agnostic, a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride, which keeps you from accepting what's in this book, I feel sorry for you. If you still think you're strong enough to beat the game alone, that is your affair. But if you really and truly want to quit drinking liquor for good and all, and sincerely feel you must have some help, we know we have an answer for you. It never fails. If you go about it with one half of the zeal you have been in the habit of showing when you were getting another drink, your Heavenly Father will never let you down. Dr. Bob died on November 16th, 1950. Thank y'all.